Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Autism Empowerment Radio, your source for acceptance, enrichment, inspiration, and empowerment within the autism and Asperger's communities. Our show will be starting shortly. To listen to archives of previous broadcasts, visit www.autismempowerment.org and click the Autism Empowerment Radio tab. As a nonprofit charity, we rely on public generosity to fund our programs, special events, and support services. Thank you for considering a tax-deductible donation today. Our show is now beginning.
Well, hello, everyone. Happy November, and welcome to Autism Empowerment Radio. My name is Karen Krejcha, and I am the co-founder and executive director here at Autism Empowerment, and will be your host for today's show. For those who may not be that familiar with us, Autism Empowerment is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we are dedicated to making life better and more meaningful for individuals and families in the autism and Asperger communities locally and worldwide. Today's show recording date is Friday, November 1st. I hope everyone out there is recovering nicely from Halloween. Our family, we love to get into the holiday each year, so we do decorations and the kids dress up, and, well, we do too. We wrote a blog about it on the autismempowerment.org website, and so we invite you to check it out. Also, if any of you out there had families who celebrated and dressed up, we'd love to see you in your costumes. Please feel free to share those pictures with us at the Autism Empowerment Facebook page, or if you'd like, send them in to us through an email, and we'll be happy to share those at autismempowerment.org. I'd like to say a special thanks to our recent guest, Monica Meyer from the Community Autism Network here in Southwest Washington. CAN is having their Focus on Family conference tomorrow at Tukes Valley School in Battleground, and they are still accepting registrations at the door. So if you missed that show, you can visit our website, search for Monica Meyer, and you'll be able to get information about their event that's coming up. John and I will be doing training ourselves that day, but unfortunately we won't be able to catch their event. We are going to be in Beaverton, Oregon, training for our Autism and Scouting program. Also on Saturday, if you're in the Southwest Washington area, there's a harvest party for children with autism and differing abilities at the First Church of God. So if you happen to be in our area tomorrow, there's a lot to do, and I'm sure wherever you are, there's probably quite a lot of things going on as well. It's just that time of year. On Wednesday, November 6th at 10 a.m., we have a special return guest visiting Autism Empowerment Radio. We are interviewing ASPE advocate and all-around amazing woman, Jennifer Cook O'Toole. And we are going to be talking about her recent book, The Asper Kids Launchpad, and her Asper Kids series of books. So if you're interested in looking for our schedule of upcoming shows or checking out all of the different things we've had in advance, we now have pages on our website for each individual guest that we have interviewed in the past. We also have a page where you can search by topic. So that can all be found at the new website, www.autismempowerment.org. So I am very excited. Today is a real treat for me. We are delighted here at Autism Empowerment Radio to welcome well-known and respected autism expert Dr. Stephen Shore. We're going to be taking a little time to talk about his personal journey with autism, and then we'll also be discussing a variety of topics that Stephen talks about in his presentations throughout the world. We're going to be covering a bit of autism advocacy for youth and adults, disclosure, get into a little bit of education and employment if we have time. Diagnosed with atypical development and strong autistic tendencies and too sick for outpatient treatment, Dr. Stephen Shore was recommended for institutionalization back in the 60s. Nonverbal until 4 and with much support from his parents, teacher, wife, and others, Stephen is now a professor at Adelphi University, where his research focuses on matching best practice to the needs of people with autism. In addition to working with children and talking about life on the autism spectrum, Stephen presents and consults internationally on adult issues pertinent to education, relationships, employment, advocacy, and disclosure. And he is also a well-known author, as discussed in his books Beyond the Wall, which is Personal Experiences with Autism and Asperger Syndrome, Ask and Tell, Self-Advocacy and Disclosure for People on the Autism Spectrum, the critically acclaimed and well-known Understanding Autism for Dummies, and also the newly released DVD, Living Along the Autism Spectrum, What It Means to Have Autism or Asperger Syndrome. He is President Emeritus of the Asperger's Association of New England and a former board member of the Autism Society, which is actually where I first heard Dr. Shore speak. He serves in the Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee, the Asperger Syndrome and High Functioning Autism Association, United States Autism and Asperger Association, and other autism-related organizations. So I think he keeps very busy, so it's a real treat to have some of his time here today. It's a real honor and pleasure to have him visiting us here at Autism Empowerment Radio, so let's go ahead and bring him on air. Dr. Stephen Shore, welcome to Autism Empowerment Radio.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
It is a real delight. We really do appreciate it. And many of our listeners that are tuning in today have probably heard you speak or read some of your work. However, for those who are not familiar, I was hoping you would take a bit of time to tell us a bit about your personal journey, perhaps a bit about what your earliest years were like.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'd be glad to. Things were pretty typical for me for the first 18 months before I got hit with what I call the autism bug, which happens to about half of us on the autism spectrum, and I lost functional communication, had meltdowns, and became quite a severely affected child with autism. Now, in those days, there was very little known about autism. It took my parents a whole year to find a place for diagnosis. Then, finally, at 2.5, they did find a place to get me evaluated. The doctor said they had never seen a child who was so sick, and they recommended institutionalization. Fortunately, my parents, like so many parents today, they advocated on my behalf and convinced the school to take me in about a year. And it was during that year they implemented what we would today refer to as an intensive home-based early intervention program, emphasizing music, movement, sensory integration, narration, and imitation. So today we have this terminology, but in those days it was really just parents doing what parents felt they needed to do to connect to their child. I was lucky that my parents were able to figure this out. And with the work that they did, you might say it began with them trying to get me to imitate them, and that didn't work. So then they flipped it around and began imitating me. Once they did that, I became aware of them in my environment, and then we were able to move things along. So I think the critical educational implication is that before any good work gets done, you have to develop a relationship with the learner. Then you can move on. And that's what I see most of the more successful practitioners doing, whether they work with people on the autism spectrum or not. And in that way, by the time age 4 rolled around, speech had begun to return. And it was certainly a frustrating time, not being able to communicate my needs and wants, so there was certainly a lot of meltdowns in those days.
I would imagine so, but it must have been, I'm not sure how much you actually remember from that time, but it must have been comforting knowing that your parents were trying to communicate with you directly and get into your world.
Oh, sure. And I think that is key, that we need to get into the world of the individual with autism and build that trusting relationship before we can think about moving them with us into ours.
That makes perfect sense to me. What would you say were your biggest strengths and perhaps maybe your biggest challenges as a child? And how is that compared to your biggest strengths and challenges now?
I would say as a child, it was more communication and making friends and just figuring out what teachers wanted me to do in school. Whereas now, some of the challenges dealing with subtle social situations, for example, such as office politics, or dealing with mixed messages when someone says one thing but actually means another, so there's a certain amount of decoding that needs to be done. And then there are the sensory issues, which existed as a child and still exist to this day, but I know better how to accommodate or work around them.
Have you found any sensory issues that have become more pronounced as you've gotten older?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I remember always being bothered by sounds and bright lights. And I think when it's gotten older is I become more aware of them and know what to do with them, and instead of having just an amorphous sense of discomfort when these things were occurring.
Yeah, I think it really helps being aware of it. I wasn't diagnosed when I was young. I was diagnosed actually in my 40s, but I've noticed more sensory sensitivities as I've gotten older, and I was wondering if it's perhaps because I'm more aware of it now, or if maybe, you know, there's something that changes in the body over time. But certainly being aware
question.
Of things does help.
awareness definitely helps.
Uh-huh.
You see a lot of older people, for example, wearing these big sunglasses. So
yes.
They must have sensitivity to light as well. So maybe it's also part of the aging process.
So other things to look forward to as we get older, right?
Oh, yeah.
What kind of family and educational support do you remember?
Well, educationally, there really didn't seem to be much support at the elementary school level. I entered, stepping back a little bit, I entered school that initially rejected me and recommended institutionalization at age 4. And I suppose there it was more of a play type of situation. Maybe we'd almost call it floor time of today. Mm-hmm. And so what was going on then, although that terminology didn't exist. And by age 6, I entered regular school kindergarten, where there didn't seem to be that much support. Teachers didn't quite know how to reach me, I felt. But at the same time, I wasn't a behavior problem. So they just kind of left me to my own devices. And what those devices were to go into the library to take out all the books based on whatever special interest I had. It might have been dinosaurs, it could have been earthquakes, the weather, or something else. And I'd read all those books, take notes, and copy diagrams. And sometimes I'd even wonder if there was more to school than just reading books on my favorite subjects. And I guess for better or for worse, because they knew so little about autism and special education then, it was probably better they just left me alone.
So your special interest at the time, they just kind of let you go, and if you were into dinosaurs at the time, that's what you'd be reading about?
Yeah, exactly. How much the teachers were aware of what I was doing, I'm not sure. But I wasn't creating a ruckus, so I wasn't drawing that much attention to myself. So maybe they just didn't notice, or maybe they were just happy that there was one less child that had to be managed, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember in the 3rd grade that I had a stack of astronomy books on my desk, and teacher came up to me and told me that I'd never learned how to do math. But somehow I figured out just enough math to teach statistics at the university level. And the good news is that today an educator would probably notice such an interest and find a way to work it into the curriculum, but they didn't do that in those days.
Have you ever thought about going back to that teacher?
Yeah, sometimes I think about it. I have no idea where she is, though. Maybe she's read my book. Who knows?
I hope so,
yeah,
if not, someone should send her a copy.
Right.
So you're now a professor at Adelphi University, and you specialize in special education. Why did you decide to get into this field of work? Kind of what was the process of getting there? And what would you say a typical week looks like now? Maybe you can talk about a little bit about your journey there.
Yeah, sure. Well, for a long time I've known I've wanted to be a teacher. It just seemed to be a really cool thing to do. And I remember especially in college, I would sit in the classes learning whatever I needed to learn, But at the same time, also thinking how I might teach this myself, so I always took good notes because I thought, well, I might need this information later when I teach this material on my own. And originally I had concentrated on being a music teacher.
Oh.
And being a band director. And I thought that was a cool thing to do because music was a special interest of mine, especially beginning in middle school, where I'd spend hours in the instrument closet just figuring out how to play all the instruments. I just thought that was a neat thing to do. So I did figure out a number of instruments. And when I heard that one of the requirements for a degree in music education was that you had to learn all the instruments, I thought that was a really, okay, that's really neat. I can do that. I've already done some of it. So I'm going to study that. However, as time went on, as I went through my bachelor's, master's, and doctorate, I had, current level, I'd gotten through all the courses pretty well, but there was a challenge that was related to being on the autism spectrum that I just didn't seem to overcome in the comprehensive exams, which you need to take after you complete your coursework but before you do your dissertation. So it got to a point where it didn't seem to be an insurmountable barrier, but it seemed like there might have been a lot of time that would have to be spent with lawyers and legal type things, or I could just find something else that was interesting to do. And that's what I did. Given my background in autism, both personal and interest at that time, I decided to go into special education. So I defected from music to special education and got a doctorate there because at that point my goal was to use my personal, practical, and academic experiences to help individuals with autism lead fulfilling and productive lives.
And who better to do that than someone who has gone through it himself?
Today, where I pretty much divide my time between teaching and researching at the university, teaching courses mostly in autism or special education, researching into best practices, and also researching into our program, a support program that we have that supports students with Asperger's syndrome in the university, writing books and articles and newsletters and journals. I also do a lot of presenting at conferences. So far, I've presented in 31 countries across 6 continents, and there's only 4 states left in the United States that I need to go and give a talk at. And
which
spare time
which
when I'm
states
home,
are those?
I give music lessons to children with autism.
We're going to have to get those states to invite you to present because I think you need to have all 50. I was wondering if you had could remember back.
And
to
I don't hear you, so oh. I'm thinking we got disconnected.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me? Uh-oh. Dr. Shore's call dropped. Hopefully he will come back on in just a moment. I don't know if he can hear me, but the number to call in is 602-753-1530. This is such an interesting conversation that we're having. I think here he's back.
I'm back. I wish there was a way to know when we get disconnected. Yeah.
Ah, how rude, huh? Thank you so much for calling back so quickly.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry. I was just saying that, you know, right before we got cut off, that the other 4 states that haven't had you present yet need to invite you.
Oh, yeah, they do. And if I can speak at a conference in either Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, or Mississippi, then I will have gotten all the states down.
That's wonderful. That, so anybody who's listening in from those states, here's your opportunity to have Dr. Stephen Shore come present. So be sure to get right on that and visit him at his site, which is autismasperger.net. Stephen, I wanted to ask you about social issues. Do you remember having any social issues in high school or college that affected your ability to perform academically?
Well, in high school, it's hard to know if there were any social issues that interfered with my academic performance, because I always did reasonably well in either one. It might be that the social issues more impacted my ability to interact with my classmates, which was probably more of a challenge in elementary school, because mm-hmm. it wasn't until middle and high school that I figured using words instead of sound effects from the environment really helped with social interaction.
Yes. What would you say were the biggest challenges you had socially?
I would say making friends.
Mm-hmm.
There was bullying, especially in elementary, some in middle, and then not so much in high school. I would say those are probably the two biggest areas.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that still seems to be a challenge today with some families.
Yeah. Indeed. It seems like that school systems are now beginning to realize that bullying is not a developmental phase that people need to go through.
No, it seems like when I was growing up a lot of times teachers would look the other way.
Right.
But fortunately nowadays, it's certainly, you know, hopefully with the education that's being put out there, people are understanding that, no, this is something that needs to be taken care of right away.
Right.
You've mentioned, I want to kind of switch gears a little bit here. You've mentioned in some of your writings that autism is dynamic versus static. I was wondering, because your skill set has changed so much over the years, do you consider yourself as autistic or Aspie or both? Or what are your thoughts in that area?
Well, I consider Asperger syndrome to be a part of autism, even though the people who just released the fifth edition of the DSM don't think so. So sometimes I'd wonder if I had Asperger syndrome or if I had autism, and then I figured that it didn't really matter because it was just autism spectrum. That was good enough for me. The characteristics are still there. I think what happens is that as time goes on, we learn better how to work around them and through them, or perhaps even just avoid situations where things are really difficult and you might say we're really low functioning. So, for example, I know I'm very low functioning in a noisy bar. There's just too much sensory input, too much nonverbal communication, so I can just get by without going into them.
Yeah.
And
fortunately, you're aware.
I'm very high functioning in a classroom or in a university setting, so I try to spend more of my time there.
You mentioned the DSM-5, and I was wondering what your thoughts were. Do you think that the changes, where Asperger syndrome has been removed and it's all autism spectrum disorder, do you think that those changes are going to adversely impact individuals with Asperger's in terms of diagnosis and receiving services?
It's hard to say. All I can say is that there's a lot of challenges that we face, because people who would have been diagnosed with autism, with what we call high-functioning autism or Asperger syndrome, may very well end up being recategorized into social communication disorder. And the question is, how do we support someone with social communication disorder? And the teachers, clinicians, and parents, and therapists The answer is actually very easy. There's nothing different that you have to do because they're still the same kids, whatever their label is. But I think where the challenge may come is in the administrative arena and perhaps in the diagnostic arena, where there's going to be need to recognize what these individuals with those diagnoses are going to need for supports, which is actually no different from what they've always needed. But do they know that?
Yeah.
So I think that's where we're going to see a challenge.
Yeah, I've already, you know, here in Washington, in our area at least, they're still grandfathering the DSM-4. They're not really taking into account the DSM-5 yet in terms of services. As you mentioned, I just hope that teachers out there and people who are working with kids on the autism spectrum will just treat them for, you know, as individuals for who they are and help them with the areas that they need that help with and not look at a label or a diagnostic change, but just the individual and how they can best serve them.
Right, that's what we need, is ideally providing support on a non-categorical basis, so based on need as opposed to a collection of accommodations that one might think a person needs because they have a certain label, be it autism or something else.
You know, that you make such a good point there, and I guess my worry and my fear is that parents with kids that haven't yet been diagnosed and they're just starting to present some of these characteristics, they may get that social communication disorder diagnosis, and they won't be seen. I mean, they're really on the autism spectrum, and they won't get those services. Do you have any suggestions? Should parents, if they feel that their children are not getting the appropriate services, should they try to go again for a second opinion? What do you suggest practically that families do?
I think until people figure out what to do with this social communication and also disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, which is, in other words, a meltdown, or the more severely affected and global delay. We're going to see people get reclassified as having a global delay. And I think those might be individuals who we haven't quite figured out a reliable means of communication with them yet, but they'll clearly still have their challenges. So I think they're going to receive supports that they need. It's at the other end where it's possible that social communication disorder might be considered as a super high-functioning version of autism that isn't really worth being called autism. And maybe if they just try a little bit harder, they'll be able to figure out how to socially interact with others or do whatever else they need. I think what's going to happen, and I do see this happening in some cases, at least until this gets sorted out, is you might see in diagnostic reports social communication disorder formerly would have been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, people know what Asperger's syndrome is and what to do with it.
Yeah.
We're seeing in book titles, autism and related disorders. We're seeing in school requirements, the Boston Higashi School, for example, they're a school for children with autism and only for children with autism. But they're now going to have to change to students with autism and related disorders. And what could potentially be even more confusing is that unless you know the history of the label, there's no way for anybody to know that social communication disorder used to be considered as part of autism and requires interventions and supports that relate to autism. So it's going to be a bit of a transition.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think that hopefully parents will be able to still, you know, obviously there's a lot of literature out there, a lot of really good online places for people to go to find out more about Asperger's syndrome And I'm hoping that if a parent does get that social communication disorder diagnosis, that they're still able to somehow tap into or plug into to that information that's out there so that that can better support their child or themselves if they're getting the diagnosis themselves.
Right.
So, Stephen,
it will be a bit of a... Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I just said it's going to be a bit of a transition, and we don't know what the future is going to hold. One good aspect, or some good aspects of the DSM-5, it's not all bad, is that, for one, sensory issues are now considered as a characteristic of autism, so that's helpful because I've yet to meet somebody on the autism spectrum who doesn't have sensory issues. And there's also recognition that while autism does appear in early childhood, it may not be noticed until much later, possibly in adulthood, when the complexity of life overwhelms the ability to cope. So that's a couple of good things that we see in the DSM-5.
I agree with you there, and especially those sensory issues a lot of times for adults to be able to understand the difference between what's, you know, sensory and what is like a behavior type of issue. So I'm glad that there is some more clarification and support around that.
Oh, yeah.
Stephen, I was on your website, which is really good, autismasperger.net, for any of our listeners out there who would like to visit. And you even alluded to this earlier, that you've made hundreds of presentations around the world. Actually, I read that you have presented on 6 continents. Only the Antarctica remains, where you joked on your website, or maybe it wasn't joking, I don't know, that you know there must be some penguins with autism. I love that. Our oldest son, his favorite animal is penguins, and so we all got a kick out of that line. I was wondering if you could share with our listeners, since you've traveled so well, what was the most recent place you traveled to? And actually, how well do you do with the travel in general? Are there any sensory issues, and how do you overcome that?
All right. Well, my last overseas trip was to Budapest for the World for the Europe Autism Congress. And I've traveled to a few places in the United States since then. That was in September. And next week I'll be headed out to Ireland, conference titled Challenging the DSM-5. So that should be a very interesting conference.
Oh, I bet.
Dublin, Ireland. So that's what's coming up next. There'll be some additional presentations, I think all in either New York and Massachusetts to round out the year. And then once the new year starts, it starts with a bang with a presentation out in England for the National Autistic Society to talk about using strengths to promote success for individuals with autism. And then we'll hightail it down to Florida to speak at another conference for CEC, Council for Exceptional Children, on sensory issues, and then it's back home and for a little bit, do some teaching, then it's off to Qatar to give a presentation for a new school that's building, that they're developing out there, and it just goes on and on.
Oh, wow. I am so impressed. Does the travel part, the airplane, the jet lag, do you ever get bothered by any of that, or are there any sensory issues that come up during the travel?
Well, there certainly can be, but I figured out a way to accommodate them for the most part. One is noise-canceling headphones help a lot with noise on airplanes. Since I'm hyposensitive in the vestibular proprioceptive sense, I like the feeling of when an airplane takes off, and I like it when it goes through turbulence. So there's no problems there. As for noise in airports, I've flown enough on airlines that I can often get into their business lounge, where it's much quieter and the lights are muted, and there's even food and there's free Wi-Fi. So that's very helpful.
Yeah, I would imagine that you have racked up quite a few frequent flyer miles.
Yeah, I have. Actually, the trip to Ireland will put me over the magic 100,000-mile mark for the year on American Airlines. And once you get so many miles on an airline, they start becoming very friendly to you. And give you shorter lines to wait in and enough. So
that's good.
You
an extra benefit.
Yeah,
you know,
it is.
So you've been to so many different countries. Do you notice much of a difference? Are there things that other countries are doing that are a lot different than the United States in terms of autism research and focus?
Well, it's an important question because here in the United States, and I think it's in more than just autism, we tend to think we're the biggest, the baddest, and the best. And part of that might be because it's such a big country, and also it has two big oceans on either side, so it can get a little bit isolated. However, it's important to know that there's good work being done in other countries. And wherever I go, even in the places that seem to be most desolate and have the fewest resources, and you think there's just nothing at all and nobody knows anything, and there are a lot of challenges that these countries may not even have the wherewithal to properly count their individuals with autism, you always find a small group of people, and it's usually parents, who cobble together a center. And that's what it's usually called, a center, out of duct tape, plywood, plastic, and nails, and they put themselves together a pretty good program. And they've done their research, and they understand what their children or individuals with autism need. And that's really exciting to see. I've seen that in China and Brazil and a number of other places.
It must be very, they must be very delighted when you come in to speak, having, so much experience and being able to share. I mean, because you're bringing, obviously, your life experience, but you're bringing that every time you travel somewhere else, you're adding that knowledge base of what's going on around the world to be able to share.
Oh, yeah, it's really interesting just to see what people are doing.
Do you have any favorite place that you like to go outside of the United States?
I like going to Hawaii a lot. Alaska's a lot of fun. I certainly enjoy going to Japan whenever I go there. And let's see, where else? I enjoy going just about to everywhere I go.
Do you have any? I'm sorry, what?
Budapest was pretty exotic.
I would imagine that was. Have you ever run into any scary experiences or anything that where you just kind of felt, uh-oh, this is a really difficult experience?
No, I haven't really. No, I don't think I've run into any bad experiences. I've enjoyed all the places where I go, and whatever seems to happen, there's always something new to explore or to check out and see what people are doing. Sometimes conference organizers have a lot of activities, and that can be fun hanging out with them and doing things. And there are other times where they just kind of, you do your thing and they leave you alone, and then I just go out and see what's around.
Well, that's cool. I'm glad that you have opportunity to explore while you're there, because if you're going all the way across the world to all these wonderful countries, it's good to be able to get a flavor of their culture as well.
Oh, yeah, it certainly is. And I enjoy doing that. And sometimes, depending upon scheduling, my wife can go with me.
Oh, good. Good. Now, do you speak any other languages other than English?
Well, I speak a little bit of Russian, and that's only because I haven't been to Russia yet. I'm going to have to wait until next April for World Autism Awareness Day to get out to Russia. But I did have a couple of years that this cohort of Russians took my classes. This was in a former life when I was a music teacher. And they'd all be there, and sometimes the entire class would just be populated with these Russian students who spoke more Russian than English. Well, I picked up a few words there and found that very interesting.
That's great.
So that was pretty neat. And a little bit of Chinese, because my wife is Chinese, so I can certainly pick up some of that language from her.
So when you go to different countries and English is not the primary language, is there a translator, or do most of the countries you go to, the people understand English?
Well, that's a good question, and depending upon the country, if it's, you know, in some places it will, sometimes it's in country that speaks a lot of English, and so we don't have to worry about it. Sometimes the conference is actually an export from the United States or some other English-speaking country, so and that's kind of strange when that happens, because when you are in the conference, it feels like you're in the United States or some other Western country, but it actually might be situated in China or somewhere else. But then there are those other conferences which are more native, and it's those conferences where I need a translator, and they do provide a translator. There's a lot of background noise, too.
Yeah, is that coming from your side, do you think, or?
Yeah, it's coming from my side. Actually,
okay.
Yeah, I'm actually at a mall, because I'm going to go into an Apple store at 2 o'clock. I have an appointment to have them look at my phone.
Ah, well, we've spent a lot of time in the Apple store, too, so hopefully you'll get what you're looking for there. I wanted to say...
say that.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, say that again.
Oh, I was just saying that our families are big fans. We use iPads. We're big fans of the Apple, so we end up a lot in their store as well. So,
surprising
you got what you're looking for.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to have them look at my phone, and I think I'm going to add AppleCare. What is also interesting is the couple of times when we've claimed into each other, like we sort of interrupt each other and then wait for each other to talk, that's very much like what auditory processing disorder and auditory and delays in processing can be for, like, those of us on the autism spectrum.
Yes, I often have challenges with the phone, and I can't see your facial expressions to kind of know when I might stop or when you're going to say something. So it's always been a challenge for me to talk on the phone.
Right, and that's because, especially with cell phones, there's a delay, and you can see this delay, or I should say hear this delay very, very clearly if you call someone who's standing next to you on the cell phone. There'll be like a one-second delay, sometimes even 2 seconds between when you talk to someone and the other person hears it. And that wreaks havoc on the usual patterns of conversation between people, because there's always pauses, and people seem to know automatically just how long a pause there needs to be before they can jump in with another question. But the phones just tend to distort all of that.
Mm-hmm. They definitely do. See, I did it again. What did you say?
No, go ahead.
Okay. I was going to say, you're often quoted in the autism and Asperger community for saying, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. Whenever we say that in presentations and we attribute that to you, it really seems to resonate with others. Do you remember when you coined that phrase, and what does that phrase mean to you?
Well, first of all, I am often accused as guilty of coining that phrase. I think I remember hearing it from somewhere else, and then I remember somebody writing to me from England saying, this phrase has been attributed to you, but it was actually Lorna Wing who might have said it first.
Okay.
But I think just the best way to make attribution is that it's not always possible to go back to see who's the first one who said it, and it probably wasn't even Lorna Wing who said it first, but it might have even been someone before her. You just cite the person you hear it from, and I do say it a lot, and often get quoted, and you know that's perfectly fine. And what it means to me is that you know there are some similarities to people on the autism spectrum. There have to be, or otherwise we wouldn't be in a category. It's just that within that category, there's such incredible diversity that everyone's an individual, and that's why I like to think of that. That's why that phrase comes to mind so often. You met one person with autism, you met one person with autism. And you could probably generalize that to any category or group of people.
Well, it certainly seems to be something that people remember. It sticks in their mind.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah. There's so many things we could talk about. I'm looking at our clock. We've got about 15 minutes. I want to make sure that I'm going to jump ahead a question from where I originally was. I want to make sure you have the opportunity to talk about your books a little bit and just tell what you've published out there. So if our listeners want to connect with you after the show, they'll know how to do so. If you could talk to that briefly, and then we'll go into some strategies and tips that you can give our listeners.
All right. Beginning with the books, my first book is titled Beyond the Wall, Personal Experiences with Autism and Asperger's Syndrome. And the goal behind that book is to use the autobiographical style in which to address the challenges that children with autism face in terms of social interaction and education and the suggestions on how to best educate children on the spectrum. I also talk about giving music lessons to children with autism, as well as sensory issues. And then as time moves along towards the transition years, I talk about meeting the challenges of successfully navigating transition to adulthood. So now we're talking about employment, relationships with others, continuing education at a college or university, and just plain old living. And I talk a little bit about my involvement, my political involvement. So that's the first book. I also noticed that there were a lot of people. There was a lot of conversation about advocacy or lack of advocacy. And what I noted is that there was very little conversation in education and even less actual education on teaching people with autism to successfully advocate for themselves. So finding no material, I asked five of my colleagues, all who have autism, how are we going to best educate ourselves to successfully advocate? And that's where the second book, Ask and Tell, Self-Advocacy and Disclosure for People on the Autism Spectrum, came from. A little later on, I was approached by Wiley Publishers to co-author Understanding Autism for Dummies. And at first, I didn't want to do it because I had the word dummies in the title. Mm-hmm. But then I realized that nobody was calling people with autism a dummy, but it's sort of like a playing with words, and you feel like you need more experience or knowledge in something, so you feel like a dummy and you buy the dummy book. There's about 1,300 dummies titles, so they're very popular. And I figured that if I didn't do it, then maybe somebody else would, and there was important information that needed to be, that people needed to know. And I wrote this book especially for parents and teachers and other supporting people on the autism spectrum. And then we get to the third publication, a fourth, I should say, which is actually a DVD, Living Along the Autism Spectrum. And what that is a sort of Larry King-style type of interview where I talk about what life is like with autism, being on the spectrum. Robert Nassif is a father of an adult son with autism, and he takes a look at him from that side. And then there's Dan Gottlieb, who's a psychiatrist, who has a grandson with autism. So the three of us just talk about autism from our respective viewpoints.
if our listeners wanted to be able to purchase any of those titles, could they do so through your website?
Yeah, they certainly can. That's a great place to see them all in one place. And a little bit of information about each one, and then there's a link which will take you directly to the publisher's website, and you can buy as many or as few as you want.
Wonderful. And your website is www.autismasperger.net.
Yes,
and also, listeners, we do have a page on our website for Dr. Stephen Shore, and we have pictures and a little bit of information about the books there as well. So you can always check it out there as well. I would hope that I know we don't have too much time left, maybe about 10 minutes, but I was hoping that you might be able to share with our listeners some of your thoughts from your presentation talk that you give that's called Success with Autism, Using Our Strengths for Achieving a Fulfilling and Productive Life, just like everyone else. And I think that a lot of the people who wrote in and asked to hear you talk were interested in perhaps you sharing a few thoughts in the areas of education, self-advocacy, employment, disclosure, those things. So I was hoping you might be able to talk to those issues in the time that we have left.
Oh, sure. Well, we'll get to as many of them as we can.
Okay.
I guess the takeaway from my work on using strengths to promote successful people on the autism spectrum is, I guess it's exactly that. And the idea is that you determine what the strengths are of the individual with autism, and you find ways that can be can promote success in education and then later for a career. So when trying to determine what the strengths are of somebody on the autism spectrum, the question I ask is, how do they spend most of their time? Or how would they spend most of the time if they were allowed to? And you can actually ask this question to anybody, whether they have autism or not. And that usually leads to a hobby of some sort or an interest. And if you have a hobby or an interest in something, it means you're probably good at it. And that being the case, what can we do to transform that into an area of success? And sometimes you have to be a little bit creative with these things, because there may be an interest that doesn't seem like it's going to be of much use. But these interests can also be used as a way to expand the child's world. So, for example, you might have a child or an individual with autism who has a special interest in wrestling. Now, why wrestling? Who knows? But he does. And he really likes to see when the wrestlers body slam each other onto the ground. And, you know, once you get over your revulsion, if you have any, body slamming people around, you could ask the question, how much force is involved when somebody hits the ground like that, especially with these wrestlers who tend to weigh a lot? And now you're getting into mathematics. And there may be something to explore there, perhaps eventually related to engineering. You might have another individual who's fascinated with airplanes and would like nothing more than to be a pilot. And this interest can be used in education. So, for example, if a child's having difficulty with math, let's use the topic of airplanes in which to study math, because there's plenty of math involved with airplanes. You can also use airplanes to introduce different cultures, say in social studies. Where do airplanes fly? Okay, let's check out the culture in that country and see what people do over there. And in that way, make the curriculum intrinsically rewarding. And when we time to move on to careers, it may be that the individual can become a pilot. I know a number of people with Asperger's syndrome who are very, very good pilots. You also may have the situation where, at least at this point, you may have an individual who may not develop cognitively to the point where they can become a pilot. And if that's the case, is there something else that they could do that would still get them close to airplanes, perhaps working in an airport in one way or another? So that's what I mean by being flexible with the interest.
And I think that, you know, certainly when people show a genuine interest in someone else's special interest, it builds additional communication, additional bonds with that person.
Right. So wherever possible, instead of using the interest as an extrinsic reward, okay, if you're good at math, you can play on the flight simulator for the last 10 minutes of class. That's an extrinsic reward. And your work, that is supposed to motivate the person to get through the work, something that they'd rather not do, but they can do something they can do. However, I think it might be more rewarding, or it is more rewarding, if we say, all right, how many airplanes does it take to move a certain amount of cargo? Or the airplane flies this fast, this many miles an hour, how long is it going to take to get to France? And this is how far France is. So we can create equations. And in that way, use the interest directly in whatever curriculum that is.
That's terrific advice. Now, say they want to, say they end up using those special interests and making a career out of it, and they're getting to employment and they have a decision on whether or not to disclose whether they're on the spectrum. Or actually, this could be even, we have a lot of people who ask just about disclosure in general, about when is a good time to tell others that they are on the spectrum or their child's on the spectrum. I was wondering what your thoughts were in that area.
All right, and I see it's about 2 o'clock, so I'm going to have to fly into the Apple store after this one.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'll lose my case.
I don't want you to lose your place.
All right, as for disclosure, I think the best way to think about this is that if the effect of autism or Asperger's syndrome significantly impacts a situation or a relationship, like doing a job properly or developing greater understanding between you and your boss or between you and their friend or a significant other, then it's time to start thinking about disclosure. It's time to start thinking about advocacy, because the two often go hand in hand.
That's great advice. And, you know, I don't want you to miss your appointment, but I'm hoping that you would, I know your time is, very valuable and that you're very busy, but I'm hoping that you would be willing to come back to Autism Empowerment Radio in the future, because you just have so much wisdom to share and you're so kind of a person. Great to talk to. We hope that you'll come back with us in the future.
Oh, yeah, I'd be glad to. Just send me an email and we'll set up another time and maybe talk more about self-advocacy.
That sounds great. I think that we could do a whole show on that. So I will go ahead and connect with you. Okay.
All right.
So I am going to go ahead and let you go so that you do not miss your appointment. Listeners, that was Dr. Stephen Shore here at Autism Empowerment Radio, such a wonderful man. And we hope you enjoyed the show today. If you'd like to connect with him afterwards, you can do so by visiting www.autismasperger.net or visit our autismempowerment.org website and search his name, and you'll be able to find information about how to connect with him there as well. Stephen, thank you so much for taking your time to come on our show, and I hope that all of your future conferences and talks go wonderfully.
All right, thanks.
Okay, I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks, you too.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So this has been Karen Krecha with Autism Empowerment Radio talking with you today. We just had a wonderful with Dr. Stephen Shore. Be sure to tune in on Wednesday, November 6th at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, 1 p.m. Eastern, when we will be talking with Jennifer Cook O'Toole about Asperger Kids and the Asperger Kids Launchpad. I will definitely be contacting Dr. Shore to have a show on self-advocacy and advocacy topics. If you have any questions that you would like for Dr. Shore to answer on air during our next show, please feel free to send those in to Karen@autismempowerment.org. Thank you very much for tuning into our show today, and have a wonderful rest of the day. Goodbye.